listening to the AI in Motion podcast with JP Morgenthal. Hi, everyone. It's JP Morgenthal here. I'm the host of AI in Motion, the podcast about everything AI in manufacturing and supply chain. Today, I have a guest with me, a repeat guest, Dr. Matthew Alberts. Dr. Alberts has been on before. Last time we had a really great conversation about AI and particularly about around the role that he's in now, which is around utilities. Just recently, Dr. Matthews released his book, or his book was released publicly. His book is The Gen AI Manufacturing Revolution. So we wanted to invite Dr. Alberts back again. This time, I really wanted to talk about what we ran out of time last time, and that's to dig into his book a little and get into some of the meat of the content, since he used a lot of the material for that book for his doctoral thesis, and it has a lot of real world value. So Matt, welcome back. Thank you again. And to get started, why don't you talk a little bit about the book itself this time? Go into a little detail. Let us know about the audience and about the content.
Yeah, no, thanks, JP. Thanks for having me back again. Very excited to have the book released. It was released a little bit ago. I've actually had the pleasure of finding it in a few bookstores. So that's always great to see the book actually on the shelf.
And you took it out and you turned it outward, right? So that everybody can see.
Yeah, let me put it on the edge cap. Let me show you new releases. I've gotten good feedback from people so far that have read it. When I think of describing the book on kind of what it is, to me, it is that playbook or roadmap, I think, to how organizations need to reshape themselves with regard to artificial intelligence, right? And I focus on mainly the two topics of generative and agentic AI, because I think they go hand in hand, but usually that's where most people have the experience with is with generative AI. I think we've all asked ChatGPT some questions, or we ask ChatGPT questions every single day. And that's usually where I think a lot of companies are right now, is they're dipping their toe into the generative AI space. They're building chatbots. But the big thing too, with the report I think that came out maybe, I think by now about 2 months ago from MIT, JP, have you seen the numbers on how much companies have spent on AI in the last year or two? Right.
I haven't seen any numbers about spending, just about failures.
Well, I think you're right. I think from the report from MIT,
I think it was the same report. I just didn't. I only saw excerpts, so I didn't know that report actually had investments that were made in AI. What did it look like?
Yeah, so they were estimated in between somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 to $40 billion.
Wow.
Spent on AI.
Wow.
And like you mentioned, hey, you got drawn to the failures, and I think they were estimating, companies could claim successes in like the 1 to 2% of that. So to me, it's a lot of misses. I would say where I come from, that's not the cost of doing business, that's not a learning opportunity, that's a straight up failure. And I don't think many people could classify it anything other than that.
Well, it's a race, right? I mean, it's like, I didn't train for the marathon, but I better get in, because if I don't, then everybody who's in the marathon is going to have an advantage over me. But it's 26 miles. You're probably not going to make it past 3/4 of the first mile, but good luck with that.
No, I mean, yeah, you're exactly right. I think it's just a lot of people not asking the right question. It's a race. It's a rush. We want to put out social media posts on how our company is transforming itself with AI, or we're becoming more of a transformational or technology based company. And, we have this new AI in our software, new AI in our company, because that's what we want to sell people on. We want our valuation to be not 5x, be 10x, because we can say and claim we're an AI company or we're a technology-based company, right? So, yeah, it's a race, but I think it's that artificial inflation of a race and of value. And
it's interesting. I've been coaching an executive recently on AI, and he's had some ideas that he's wanted to kind of turn into a product for a while. And so one of the things that I turned him on to was Claude Code. And he and it's really interesting. First of all, he's really embraced Claude Code as a way to take his ideas and turn it into something he can actually interact with. It is phenomenal at doing that. And what I learned watching him, I learned a couple of things, because you and I think are technical people, right? And as technical people, what I found to be true is that we, and he said it to me, we think we're smarter than the AI thing. We're smarter than Copilot. We're smarter than OpenAI. We're smarter than ChatGPT. We're smarter in the fact that we know how we build things, or and how we've built things in the past. And so we want to guide these LLMs. We want to turn them into our slaves. We want them to do our bidding in the way that we want it done. I want you to put up that molding in the house, and I want a 45-degree angle, and I wanted it. We're not hiring a carpenter and just saying, do your thing, man. You're a great carpenter, right? He didn't know. He's not a programmer. He had no preconceived notion of what this thing could do other than what he's seen me do with it. And he really didn't have any clue as to what to ask for. And he just interacted with it. Like he just like typed, like he wasn't guiding it. He was just saying, I like this color. And I like this. And, you know, as I'm watching him type, I'm feeling cringed because it's like, no, you gotta tell it to not do this. Yes. But I just let him go. And it was like, I like mauve and I like top, it's colors and scheme. And it was just mind, just letting his mind go. And it created the most amazing output. So to your point, right, it's like, I think a lot of these failures are because they've turned the requirements over to people who have a bias, who are trying to turn this slave, make this slave do what they want to do, instead of turning it over to everyone else but the technical people and seeing what they can do with it, right? So.
Well, I think too, it's they looked at AI as being this magical thing, this magical easy button, and really what they got early on was they thought they could ask ChatGPT any question and trust what it was going to do and give them and think, hey, if I give it this data, that what it's going to give me is going to be gold. And well, hey, we got nothing but lead, right? Like, and I think that was the realization that a lot of companies had, right?
It's gold plated.
I wish it was gold plated, then it would even look nice.
Fair enough. All right, but we're jumping in early. Let's just for a couple of minutes, stick with the book, man. I know you have immense pride about this, right? Talk about it like it's one of your children. tell us what's in this book. You put your heart. I'm an author. I've written books. I'm working on another one now, even though I swore off never writing a book again, because it is a labor of love and it's very, very labor intensive to put your brain into words. So tell us, right? Tell us what you created here. Tell us about your creation.
Well, yeah, it's sometimes I too think of it like, and like you said, JP, you've written books. Sometimes I think of it too. It's like, okay, what did I have to leave out to fit it in the book format, right? Like, so I kind of missed some things I had to leave out, but at the same time, right? Yeah, it's so, you know, 22 chapters, really driven at being, if I could sit down with a company and tell them, hey, this is the roadmap, this is the playbook you need to have on how your company needs to reshape itself for AI, to take advantage of AI broadly across the system, this is the book I'm going to use to deliver that message and build out how a company needs to go through that type of transformation, right? We're not talking industry 4.0 transformation of, predict IoT sensors and cloud-based and edge-based analytics and, no, it's more so than that, because hey, I think a lot of companies didn't even do Industry 4.0 that well, right? And now we hear Industry 5.0 coming out, and we're going to sprinkle in AI across it. Well, you know, a lot of times they'd say, hey, why are you worried about advanced analytics if you still can't do your oil analysis very well, right? Or you're not doing great at lubricating all the bearings in the plant, right? So you're not building that base foundation. But for me, it's also the goal of where I think, you know, leadership of companies haven't grasped this type of technology in the past. And they haven't had to be concerned with, you know, being experts on the cloud or being experts on, you know, Industry 4.0. It's like, because they hire smart people in their companies to do that. Well, I think with regards to AI, they can't afford not to be have some level of expertise in that, because they have to drive it for their company.
Did you talk specifically in the book about what industry 4.0 and 5.0, or how that will have to, or how that is impacted by the, you know, by the appearance of AI, generative AI into the world? I mean, do you have a statement on that in the book that talks about the way that people who do Industry 4.0 look at the world, look at manufacturing and look at, you know, supply chain and will they be able to just incorporate AI, or is it a fundamental shift for that audience, for that group?
No, it's a fundamental shift, right? I think that's where the idea of these, you know, Industry 4.0 to Industry 5.0 revolutions, they're almost, in my mind, they're almost these little footnotes when you think of AI, if you just talk about the AI revolution in general, right? They're going to be inherently more enabled by AI. Right. We talk about, you know, a key concept of Industry 4.0 was kind of like IoT sensors. Well, hey, moving to 5.0 is almost like, hey, how do we apply AI to those data? That data is coming off of those IoT sensors. But also not just apply AI on predictive nature, but grow it into more the agentic decision making side of things. Right. And so to where I see AI has almost brought on that 5.0 revolution before we're ready for it. And I think that's a underlying, you know, theme of my book, is that we don't have the capacity to say we're not ready for this yet. We're going to wait, because it's going to pass us by so fast that when the other company says, hey, we're ready for it, that's your competitor, you won't ever be able to catch back up to that. And to where it's, you cannot afford to sit idly by during this revolution. And hey, it's not just a bus you're getting on. You're climbing on the back of an F1 car. It's going to move hella fast. And if you're not ready to move hella fast, you're going to fall off. And yeah, it's not going to come back around to pick you up.
Well, to your point that you made earlier, right, about failures and it being a cost of business, it really then, those failures are a cost of doing business, right? I mean, based upon what you just said, I have to put that money into learning. An education, or I'm going to miss the bus and not be able to catch up. So failures are, you know, inherent in the exploration of this technology in order to compete, in order to play in the game, right? It's you buying your lottery ticket, and you may lose the lottery, but if you don't play, you certainly aren't going to win the lottery.
That's right. Yeah, it's always, you got to pay to play, but also, hey, you don't win if you don't play, right? It's a, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
That's right. So, I mean, you know, this sounds, I mean, it's a horrible place to be, right? I mean, it's it is costly. AI is costly. It's costly to use. It's costly to engage with. I remember, you know, me working early on in the environment, I'm like, you know, who's, you know, things have gotten a little better, but at one point it was looking like it was going to be $3,000 a month to like really utilize it for software engineering. Now I pay $100 a month for unlimited Claude Max, and it, you know, and it does a lot for that $100. It is well spent $100 a month, but you know, that's only a recent change. And you know, it's before that we were looking at, you know, significant dollars, thousands of dollars a month, which individuals just don't have to invest just to learn, just to be a player. So yeah, I get that the cost of, and when you're a business, those, I'm lucky, I'm an individual, so I can leverage a max plan. That isn't available for a business. They're paying by the drink. Every, you know, they're paying for tokens. And it can get expensive when you got, you know, 30,000 employees and, you know, 50 to 60% of them are now using, you know, LLMs in their jobs.
No, it's, you know, it's one of those things that you think about how technology has propagated itself. And, you know, you think of how long did it take, you know, telephones to be used by 100 million people? How long did it take cell phones to be used by 100 million people? Then we look at ChatGPT and LLM, and how long did it take for ChatGPT to get 100 million users, right? Was it a month?
Month, yeah.
Right? So it's like, was it years? Was it decades? Was it a century? It was a literal month. And so it's like, you show that, and it's like, okay, that's the speed now that we're moving. So the book, I want you to be uncomfortable with where you're at. Because if you don't feel uncomfortable, you don't want to change. But if I can get you to feel uncomfortable, that's where I start with the book of, you know, wanting you to feel uncomfortable. So talking about, you know, where we're at in society, the kind of like some preemptive stuff of like, okay, we're getting closer to that 1 degree world, right? We're sitting around a 3 right now, but we're getting more connected personally, but also this enables us to be more connected, you know, in the industry as well. And what does that mean from a value perspective,
well,
right?
So, well, if I could ask a question about that, did you address in the book, because you did focus on manufacturing, the need for edge computing and putting this technology at the edge because of the nature of plants and disconnectedness from centralized clouds and things like that?
I think what I touch on the book is around the edge was it being a vessel and a tool that your workforce needs to understand and understand where the application needs to be. Because again, I think it's that broadly of like, okay, I can't have leadership come in and say, hey, we need everything ran at the edge tomorrow, right? Without understanding, okay, that's not the correct application in every regard for how AI needs to be deployed. In some cases, yes, we need edge deployments. In some cases, we need cloud deployments. In some cases, we need full on-prem deployments, right? And it's having to build that workforce that can help make those determinations. And without leadership, it becoming from a top-down leadership, and not just, hey, you shall go do this, but you shall go do this for these reasons, and helping build out that workforce that can understand and help you make those decisions responsibly of where to deploy AI at, how it needs to be deployed, what in-house and, you know, external expertise you need for your company to fully grasp this and take you on this journey. And oh yeah, you know, I don't think this is a journey you're going to do that you're going to run down for the next 10 years. This is probably a journey you need to do somewhere over the next, you know, 18 to 24 months. If not, like I said, you're going to miss the bus, you're going to miss the boat, and another one's not coming for a long time, if at all. So, you know, that's really where I'm focusing on. Not so much. The book's not going to give you that technical guide on how to build Python scripts predictive analytics. And I think sometimes people kind of are looking for that. And it's not so much meant to be that depth of technical resources. But overall, I think what you'd see is where companies have shown value, they've shown value in very niche areas, right? And every company has different areas they've been able to show value around AI in. You know, how I've equated it in a couple of talks I've given is we've been very good at gardening. And what I mean by gardening with AI is we've been very good going in our backyard and planting little seeds of tomato plants and peppers and flowers. And we're doing these niche projects. And hey, that tomato plant sprouts up and I get 20 cherry tomatoes on. I get a couple peppers. The flowers look great. And I said, man, we're doing a great job. All right, but did I calculate? I've had to build a raised bed. I had to go buy the soil. I had to buy fertilizer. I put in a smart watering drip system so I didn't have to water it every day, right? You know, I was very protective in windstorms and stuff. So, hey, it cost me a lot to just grow those cherry tomatoes. And, hey, I felt good. I had cherry tomatoes for my salad for my dinner one night, 1 week. And I felt good because I grew my own tomatoes. But, hey, guess what? When I had a salad the next night, where did I have to go get cherry tomatoes? Or I had to go back to the store. All right, so gardening gets us something, but it's not sustainable. So we got to stop gardening and we got to start building that forest, because that forest is what is sustaining, right?
That's an interesting analogy. I get it. It's a good analogy, because you're right. There's a whole cost. You've invested all this money for one salad. Where's your break even, right? And the technologists aren't very good at, this is a really interesting thing I've noticed. Technologists, so people expect the CIO to be the person who manages the finances and the investment around technology. But the truth of the matter is most CIOs just are not technologists. They aren't. They come from a different grain. They're usually handpicked from more of a finance and a background than they are from a technology background. That's more the CTO. So they have these CIOs, and the CIOs don't understand the technology, and they delegate to the engineers, and the engineers have no clue or don't give a darn about, you know, break evens and when that technology decision they make is going to get paid for, if it'll ever make money or be profitable, right? So you have this disconnect. So and it's going to get, I think it's exacerbated now. I think the CIO is the absolute wrong person to ever go near your AI projects at all. I don't think you should let them touch your AI projects in 90% of cases. Now, it's individualized. You know your CIO, but you have to have the honest discussion. Jim, Susie, let's be honest. You're very good at managing the contract relationships with Oracle and Microsoft, but there's no way in hell you understand what AI is or the implications for this organization. I'm going to have to go get a chief AI officer and put them in, because I can't count on you to be able to make the proper connections as to, am I gardening and getting one salad, or am I building a forest? Let's just stop for a moment there. And we're going to take a quick break. Be right back. And we're back. Okay. When before the break, we were talking about gardening versus building, growing forests. And I went off on a soapbox about what part of the failures are, let's face it, leadership. Let's talk about leadership. Does the book address leadership issues?
Well, yeah, I think what I focus on, again, is leadership, right? And what leaders need to understand about how AI is going to impact not just one facet of the business, right? It's not just your IT or technology organization. It's your complete business model. And so, yes, there is a gap in leadership. And so I think I want leaders to feel uncomfortable because they haven't addressed this. They haven't asked the right questions of AI yet.
Well, I gave you my idea about what one of the things that I think the organization needs to do. What do you recommend? What did you talk about in the book with regard to getting this stuff under control? Who is the right person or right group of people?
Well, yeah, I think in the book, right, it starts with your senior leaders, right? It starts there at the top, right? Because I think from your CEO, your CIO, your CTO, you can't afford anymore for them to say, no, you go learn this. This is your area. No, go hire somebody smart to go learn it, right? You know, I don't disagree with you. You need that AI architect. You need that AI, that person completely responsible for AI for the company. But it can't be like, hey, he's going to go do it for us. We can ignore and just let him operate AI in a bubble for us and go back to traditional.
That's right.
Right? So to me, that's part of it, right? It's building that AI first mindset. And this is one of the things I talk about early on in the book, is building that AI first mindset. And not just from the fact of, hey, can we apply AI to this process? But it's, how do we need to think about things in terms of what AI can do for us, or how AI is going to impact this business process? And it always has to be in your mind that if we don't do something, say in supply chain with AI, what happens if our competitor does it before us, right? Can we afford for them to figure this out before us? Or can we afford for them to figure this out where we're not even thinking about it? And that's where I say it has to start broadly at that top leadership and have that trickle down across all facets of the business. And really, you know, I think of it in regards to, you know, if I would go to, you know, Google has the ability of being a technology company. And they have the ability to allow their employees to have time, right? Whether it's a day a week a month a year, to think innovatively, right? And they give them the ability to have the freedom to think innovatively. Well, I know in a lot of industries, we don't let our employees think innovatively, right? They're, you know,
there's no time.
They're 40 hours a week they're working for us. They're doing a job and that's what they think about. So I think it is part of how do you build that AI-ready workforce? Well, you kind of have to give them the ability to kind of think innovatively.
Well, right? So I'm hearing two different things. You can lead the horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You can provide time, and there's plenty of time. If you and I have both been in big companies, and you know that there is plenty of time where you're sitting around and you're not directly working on work, right? It's not like you're coming in at 9 and you don't stop until 5 and you're working on whatever the business requires, right? It's probably about 30% of the time that your head's down really driving, and then you're participating in meetings, so you're contributing in other ways. And then there's time where you're just, you know, wandering or talking with people, that are in the office when you're in the office, or you might, you know, just stop and read a book, right? Take a break, read the newspaper, go to the bathroom, right? So what I mean by you can lead the horse to water is you can say, I'm giving you the tools, but you have to also incent the behavior to want to innovate. I mean, I have a choice. I can go grab a cup of coffee and walk around, or I can sit here and you know, explore 30 minutes of this AI course.
No, that's right. I think it depends too. You know, are we talking about a small business, a medium-sized business, or a large business? And I touch on that frequently throughout the book of, well, there will be differences on the size of business you run and the ability, what advantages and disadvantages that size of business gives you. You know, I think with small businesses, it's easy to say, well, we can gain a competitive advantage through efficiency without breaking the bank because we're small. And, you know, the cost of using AI for us is going to be very small for us. And hey, obviously, usually small companies are looked at as being more agile. So it's easy for them to change and say, we're going to let AI do this for us, or we only have to change the minds of 3 people to get this implemented, right? So, you know, they have an advantage in some aspects to this.
Everything you just said is 100% correct about small and mid-sized businesses. And yet I still think they're disadvantaged for one reason. Most people in those businesses are already wearing 3 hats. We talked about earlier about the people who sit around. Those people don't get to sit around because they're doing 2 to 3 jobs. They don't have a week to go take a week off and go to a training. And if they're given a week off, it's got to have significant upside value to the business to let them go for a week, because somebody's got to pick up their work. It's just the nature of the beast, right? They're wearing 3 and 4 different hats. So while I agree that they have the opportunity, I think they're disadvantaged in that they don't have the resources typically. Do you agree?
No, I think you're not wrong in that, right? You're right. They're wearing multiple hats. Limited budget too could be a constraint for them. I think too, it's like where do you allow them to wear less hats, right? Where would I tell small companies to focus in AI, right? Is it, we want to relieve customer service for a company. So customer service and chatbots, email marketing automation, AI-driven analytics. So you're not having to review information. I think marketing automation, content generation is a big thing for them, right? So how do you help people, instead of wearing 3 hats, can wear 2, right? So where you can basically say, hey, we don't have to feel like we need to double our size of employment to grow. Let's increase our capacity of what we have, right? And if I can increase each one of my person's capacity and say with 20 people, I can do the work of 30, that's going to be inherently invaluable to me in the long run, instead of saying, hey, I need to go hire 10 more people.
I think that's the secret. And I think that actually is the secret sauce to getting those executives who run those businesses interested in what you have to say is helping them. Because I think that's got to be their greatest concern right now is, you know, how am I going to meet this challenge, right? Am I going to end up digging into my pocket? The funny thing I keep thinking back is many of these businesses are not public companies. They're family-owned businesses. They're in sole ownership. When I was selling to that to those people, you know, I was selling warehouse automation and, you know, improving warehouse business processes. You know, they're looking at it at, oh, do I give this guy 60 grand or do I go buy a new boat? I mean, they are. So I know they're asking the same question. Do I bother with AI and spending my 60 grand there, or do I go get myself the new vet this year? You know, and they actually do think like that. Many small businesses, not midsize. Midsize tends to get a little more, solid in their their processes and the way they think about business. But small businesses, I know many owners, that's the decision they make. So how do you get them to wake up and go, well, would you like to be able to buy that boat in Ferrari, every couple of years? You're about to lose it.
Yeah, I think it's all about scale, right? It's like, hey, you want to buy the new vet, or do you want to buy the new Z06 vet, right? Or do you want to say you don't want the vet at all? You want to get the Ferrari, right? I think it's, how do you talk in terms of incentives, right? I think that's the piece too that I touch on in the book is, when you say we need to get people to work differently from the C-suite level down to the shop floor, how do you align incentives to do that? Because I think that's one of the biggest motivating factors for people when you're talking about we have to change how we work, right? Whether it's the industry 4.0, whether it was industry 2.0, 1.0, right? Or this AI revolution we're in now, it's you're going to ask people to work differently. You're going to ask people to change. That's going to make people uncomfortable. That's going to create pushback. But when I can properly align incentives to get people to work differently, when I can help them see the light, right? We talk a lot about human action model, right? I can make you uncomfortable with the state you're in, show you a better state out there, and then show you the path to get to that better state. Well, you should get to that better state. Well, JP, I know the human action model doesn't work for everyone. Right. I understand that I should run and work out every single day to be healthy, and I should be healthy. Right. And you show me the path to do that. And hey, I have a treadmill and stuff and I can get to the gym. And yes, I can go cook my own meals. But, like most of us, that's not the path I take every single day. Right. As I hate to admit it. So the human action model doesn't work. You know, in my mind, I can't say it's always applicable for people to say, hey, if I just show you a better way and give you the tools to get to that better place and make you uncomfortable, that you'll actually do it. Because, well, we're creatures of habit. And what do we do when I leave the room? You go back to doing it the way you were doing it.
We are creatures of habit. I live in the AI bubble these days. So I'm going to ask you a little bit of a hot question. Have you run across any doubters still? You know, anybody who just doesn't think this is real, doesn't buy into it, thinks the whole thing is a bunch of nonsense and malarkey, and is and thinks, you know, all these people rushing or into the AI, jumping into the AI volcano, or just, you know, it's human sacrifice.
Well, I think a few years ago, I think when you started seeing companies have the ability to claim 8 to 10x in value if they were looked at as a technology company, you saw some CEOs and owners of companies a little apprehensive to do anything with AI because they looked at it as a bubble that would burst. And they didn't want to be caught up in claiming they were an AI or technology company just to jump on that bandwagon of 8x or 10xing the value. Now, I'll say that with the caveat is I think they missed the boat on that one, right? I think they didn't get on the right bus, because I think we've proven that, well, hey, that valuation has stayed put. And in some cases, that valuation has gone up quite a lot if we've seen kind of what, you know, some of the OpenAI and some of the other ones are now valued at, right? But I think it's not so much doubters in it. It's now when you talk about more the ethical side of AI, right? Where should AI be used? How should it be used? Definitely on the creative side of things, right? I know you and I can go into DALL-E or ChatGPT or any of these solutions and say, hey, make me an image you know, give me a pencil drawing of a cat riding a rocket ship in outer space and make it look like it was done by a five-year-old. Okay, it'll give me exactly that. Am I cheapening art by doing that? Or I've seen the music players now that I can basically say, hey, give me a song that's in this style and in this genre and that sounds like it was produced in the mid-1990s. And hey, I'm going to make some really nice grunge rock and roll music, right? But again, it's not me doing it. So am I cheapening that art experience by doing so? Or is it okay as long as I say, hey, the tagline is this was created by AI, right? Can I put it on Spotify as long as I say it was created by AI?
Look, every day artists come out with new songs. So, I mean, this is just another artist, right? It doesn't mean that the other artists now have less of a market. Oh, AI just created a song, and I guess Cole Swindell isn't going to be able to sell anymore this year. That's not going to happen. That's not the way art works, right? Art is, you know, so somebody had an idea, but now that somebody who, you know, I don't paint well. I draw okay, but I don't paint well, right? But I could create I could take my ideas and with the help of AI, create a painting that if I could paint well, I would have painted, right? That it's still my expression. It's the expression of my brain. And that's one thing I learned working and coaching on AI, you know, people on using AI over the past 4 to 5 months it's still an expression of you. And that is an important aspect I think we shouldn't lose here. When you use AI, when you prompt, it's an expression of you. It's just taking that expression and accomplishing something that maybe isn't valuable to spend the time on, or that you may not have the skill to complete by yourself, but I don't see it as a replacement.
No, I think the case can be made for that, right? Like even what I touched on in my book is, I don't like framing up the fact that AI is going to replace people's jobs, right? I like to come at it as it's going to increase the capacity of our workers, right? It's going to allow me to do more with my time each week because it's going to make me inherently more efficient at the job I do. It's going to allow me to make better decisions, right, in the job I do. It's going to allow the company to make better decisions in the job it does. That being said, you know, I look at it from the other point of view. It's like, well, do I want an AI built, you know, actor or actress to be in movies, right? Does that cheapen that regard? Or, you know, what if you saw AI generated art in the Louvre next to the Mona Lisa? Is that cheap? I mean, you're right. It's taking somebody's concept, right? But it's my prompt now. Hey, I'm a prompt artist, right? I can write the right prompt to get it. It's not technically, I don't have the skills to paint or the skills to sing, right? But somebody is creating it through a vehicle. Right, and so I go back and forth about.
I think saying no to that is a little bit of, you know, get off my lawn. You know, people not letting go of the old world. I mean, there is we've transitioned states yet again, historically, into a new world. A new entity was introduced into our universe, and those who are against or say that that entity doesn't have a place among with all the others. Remember when they said rap didn't have a place in music, in music at the Grammys? I mean, we don't think that way anymore, right? It was a new sound, new type of music. People are like, oh, that's not music. That's just nonsense. You know, people screaming and heavy metal, hair man music. That took them forever to get into, you know, recognized by the music association as well. But it's recognized. And you have Hall of Fame artists that are both rappers and heavy metal art bands, right? We're at that stage where you have a new artist or a new type of, you know, a new entity in our universe. And the old stodgy, industry stalwarts aren't ready to let it in.
It's like anything. It's a new tool in our belt that we have to understand how and when to use it, right? It's don't use the bottom of your power drill to hammer in a nail. Right? Go get the hammer to do it, right? Like, And we're all guilty. We're all guilty of using a set of pliers to hammer in something or use the wrong tool for the wrong thing. But I think that's what it is. It's about not just having the tool in your work belt, but truly understanding its capability, its application. And every day we unlock new facets around it, right? Going from, you know, LLMs and the generative side of the AI to now getting into more of the agentic side or the reasoning side of it. So you think of LLMs as pattern matching. I mean, that's truly what generative AI is doing. It's going to find patterns and trying to match what you ask it to pass patterns to give you a result. That's why, you know, content generation is so easy, because it can say, hey, you tell me to go do that, you know, Picasso style, you know, painting. And it's saying, hey, I can go find past examples of Picasso type paintings and give you that cat riding that rocket ship in outer space in the theme of Picasso. What it can't, what, you know, what the generative side can't do really well, and I think this is where we've had a big miss in the AI piece of thinking it's magic, right, or thinking it's gold, is when you ask generative AI a question, what do you get in response to that? You don't get a system that's thinking, you know, reasonably, right? You get an answer that is based on past patterns. You get hallucinations, and I won't get into some of the big hallucinations we've seen that, you know, some folks in the country are using to drive a narrative, but we're all guilty of thinking ChatGPT gave us something that if we don't take time to go research, right, it's just hallucinated what we told it to give us.
I don't know if you saw it. I did a reel talking about hallucinations and how I don't like the word hallucination, because I think that is the entity we created. We created a creative machine. Right? It takes other things into its corpus to help create, but it's a creative machine. And then when it produces output that is not biased, like we started talking about, right? The whole bias, what I think I want the AI to do what I tell it to do. I want it to be my slave. And when it produces outside the bounds of what I want it to produce, then I get angry and I'm like, it's hallucinating. No, it's doing exactly what we created it to do. It's generative. We created a creative machine and it's doing what it was designed to do, create randomly based upon, you know, language and based upon past experience. And so to me, I've been questioning the whole hallucination thing. And just looking at it from the perspective of this, is, you know, we built the machine and we expect the machine to be deterministic, even though we built a non-deterministic machine. And so it's counterintuitive.
JP, you grasp this really well, right? And that's where I think, that's where I think, like, my target audience for the book doesn't have that same grasp of what AI is, what generative AI is today, because it is so much that if I go put a question into ChatGPT and I get an answer, I'm going to take that answer as gold. And that's not the case because, well, hey, I asked it, I prompted it, I maybe led it, and it's going to give me back what I led it to do, right? And I asked a leading question, it's going to give me an answer in response to that. Where we get into side the more agentic side of things, when you have the more of the reasoning side of things, when you can actually say, I ask it a question and have more trust in the answers you get, that's when I think we get closer to saying AI is that magic button for us. But we have to get there. And we can't assume we get there out of the box. And we can't assume we get there in a vacuum or in a bubble.
No. I do think people, like you said early on about the MIT study, there's a lot of experimentation going on, and failure is okay. Okay, let me send this out as a message to the universe. Failure is okay if you admit to yourself, I'm in learning mode. Failure is bad if you've jumped into this and said, I'm going to commit that this thing is going to do something operationally for me. And when it fails, now my business is going to suffer.
No, hey, look at it, you know, go back to the gardening example. Well, you know, you think of all the AI projects that haven't gone as good as we've wanted them to do. Well, they've created now a very fertile soil for us to go grow that forest in.
They did. Right? And at the same time, all that money, they never got a salad.
No, that's the unfortunate side of things. But again, it's a sunk cost. We're going to be moving forward. And, you know, I think that I hope my book can get in the hands of a lot of influential people that help us change the narrative for the, you know, for the next year. Right. I hope 2026 is a much better year for the value we can get out of AI.
I agree. And in fact, that's a good segue. Our time is up. Again, much success and congratulations on the book. It's a major achievement. I'm glad it's out there. I hope, again, as you just said, your audience, will recognize it for the value it has in understanding, that it's a guide to help them transform their organization. Anything that listeners need to know about the book, like can they get it at B. Dalton's or and obviously at Amazon, but anything you want to say about the book that you want to pass to the audience?
Oh yeah, I know. Book's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Go into your local bookstore, ask them to order it. Right, I like to support my local bookstores. I've seen it out in the wild in a couple bookstores. I can't say it's in every Barnes & Noble, but I've seen it in Barnes & Noble. I've seen it at different university bookstores as well. So it is out there. Go look for it. Go find it. Happy to, hopefully I see some of you guys out in the person. Love to sign books for you whenever I can. You know, I want to leave people with this, JP, because I'm thinking of back to, again, it's, why do we have the revolution now for AI? And, I think back to one of the site visits I did to a refinery, and a plant manager pulled me aside and said, "Matt, when you came in to help us with this, I didn't believe in AI. But with the AI system that you helped us develop and put in there, made sure my team went home safe today and made sure that I didn't have to call up people and tell them what happened today, because your AI system predicted when this machine was going to fail and prevented a massive, massive, massive containment leak that we could have had to deal with." And I think that's what I want people to realize, is that these systems are there to help us do our jobs better, more efficient. But in some of these industries, especially manufacturing, where we have very hazardous locations, very hazardous industries, it's not just about making people more efficient or machines smarter. It's about increasing safety, allowing our teams to work safer, allowing us to make those better decisions. And where I think it's like, my book's not just meant for those executives or those data scientists, but I think it's really, really human-centered. It's meant for anybody who believes that factories can work in a better way due to AI.
Yeah, there's a lot of improvement. And that's a great story. That's a really great story to have, and really demonstrative of the power that AI has, not just to save a buck, but to make a safer environment. All right. Well, this has been fun again, and I really appreciate you spending your time doing the podcast. I really do. I appreciate you coming on, and best of luck with the book. Thank you, Matt.
No, thank you. Thank you again, JP. I really enjoyed talking with you. Hope to be back again soon with you.